So once again, welcome everybody. I actually forgot to say a couple other things just in introducing myself. One is that I also teach at a sangha in Alameda called Alameda Sangha, which meets on Sunday nights. So if you're ever over in that area, look us up. We're on the website. We're on the... If you Google Alameda Sangha, you'll find us. And the other thing is that on November 16th, I'll be leading a day-long meditation retreat at East Bay Meditation Center with another teacher who is a wonderful leader, Mushum Ikeda. And the topic will be on loving-kindness practice. So you can go to East Bay Meditation Center and find that as well. So without further ado, I will introduce the topic for this evening. I'm very honored that James asked me to be here tonight. And when he asked if I could teach tonight, he requested that I talk about some work I've been doing around becoming more aware of racism and white privilege. And so the title for this talk tonight is Like Fish in Water, Being White in a Racist World. And I want to give a little bit of framing just from my own, I'm going to do a lot of framing from my own perspective because that's the only one I have, right? But I'm really interested in learning about my conditioning as a white person in our society and unraveling that conditioning with the intent of creating less harm in the world and with the intent of healing some of that conditioning that I know I've been steeped in so much that I often don't even realize it. So this talk has five parts. First one is kind of how I got here, a little bit about that. Second one is to talk a little bit about this analogy of fish in water, and just to reflect a bit on how racism affects us all. So I'll say a little bit more about that later. And then I'm going to spend two sections on explicitly talking a little bit about white privilege and white fragility. And then I'll end by talking about how the Dharma can really help all of us in working through our conditioning. And, you know, the intention here is that we find a way to really be the beloved community that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about. This community that's inclusive and that embodies racial and economic justice, that can embrace all of our imperfections and still extend love across difference, embracing difference, not needing to erase it or ignore it. So right now, this very day, my partner and I are painting our house. We're not painting it. We're having it painted, to be clear. Any of you who have ever had a house painted know that one of the most difficult parts is picking the color that you're going to paint your house. So we were looking at all these different colors, and there was this one color that I liked pretty well, and it's called, by the paint company, it's called Esplanade. Now, paint color names are another source of amusement because they're like, they can be pretty dissociated from reality, you know? It's like... frog. Well, you can kind of guess what color that might be, but you get the point. There's, you know, all these really amazing names. So Esplanade was this color, and it was kind of a tanny, beigey, pinky color. And after working with these colors for several days, when I was looking at this one, I had this thought, oh, it's flesh color. And the immediate resonance of that was like, Well, there were a lot of resonances, but one of them was that I am of an age that I grew up when if you were lucky, you would get a box of 64 crayons. And one of those crayons was called Flesh Color. That was the name of it. Now, I don't know that I've ever really met anyone whose skin color was that flesh color. However, it was really clear whose skin color it was supposed to represent. And it's supposed to represent the skin color of white people. So it's clear that what is historically considered normal in our society as flesh color is the flesh of white people. Yet there was this brown color that we actually picked to paint the trim of our house that could just as logically be called flesh color, as could a multitude of other colors, lighter and darker and in between. But I hadn't thought of flesh color in probably decades, and suddenly there it was. And it was like, wow, here's this manifestation of this racial conditioning that I have been steeped in, that we've all been steeped in. So James requested that I share some of my experiences in learning about whiteness and racism, and in being part of East Bay Meditation Center and doing diversity work over a long period of time. Now, I've done some work. I acknowledge that. I've taken classes on light and awakening. I've taught them several times. I've learned some stuff. I've done some work to educate myself. And I still find that it slides right off. I can't remember it. It's not in the forefront of my mind. I have to think about it for it to come up. And so there's this way in which I've been conditioned to not think about this, to not see it, to not look for it, to not acknowledge the truth of what's there. And when he asked me to do this talk tonight, it was like, okay. You know, so there was that white fragility, like I'm going to be perpetrating harm in some way, or I'm going to be pissing people off in some way. I'm going to be making people uncomfortable. I'm going to be looking like an idiot. And probably all those things are true. I don't know. But, you know, here we go. And so I just want to, you know, offer some reflections. And if they're useful for you, then please take them. And if they're not, please let them go on by. So this, you know, doubt was coming up and fear and like, what do I have to offer? What do I know? I know some stuff, but where is it? How can I, you know, I seem to have to learn it over and over again. And that's part of the picture. So I will learn it over and over again. I was born and raised in Oakland. My partner was born and raised in Oakland. My parents were born and raised in Oakland. Two of my grandparents were born and raised in Oakland. And yet I know that we're still not the original people were here. We're not the people whose land was taken away so that my ancestors could live here. I'm aware of that. And I love Oakland. And I love the diversity there, and I've chosen to remain there. I have a daughter that my partner and I raised, and, you know, she went to Oakland schools and got a good education and had a very diverse group of friends. And it was interesting because I look back on the friendships that I made with her friends, and I enjoyed this diversity of friends very much, and yet there was still some part of me that was distanced from them, that almost viewed them sort of I don't know, just with this distance, when I considered their experiences of the world, because I knew they weren't mine, because they were not white. So sometimes in my life, I have felt the pain of racial equity acutely and sharply, but lots of times I didn't really get that it was my problem too. So I had sympathy for them, those people of color who experience those isolated or not episodes of prejudice, those who have race, whereas I, as a white person, don't always see that I have race too. Those who have race and therefore have racial problems. So my attitude, largely, was, this is sad and it makes me distressed, and it's wrong to be racist, but it doesn't have much to do with me. Now, there have been a lot of experiences that have showed me that's not true. One of which was in 2002, my daughter was traveling in Europe with her boyfriend at the time, who is a man who is has an African American father and a white mother. And I was traveling in Europe. They were traveling in Europe, and our paths crossed for a few days in Zurich, and we spent some time together, which was great. My daughter's boyfriend at the time had pretty long dreadlocks, and he's lighter skinned, but it's clear that he's not classically white, right? And especially with the dreadlocks. So I went to meet them at the train station in Zurich when they got into town. We were walking through the train station, and some other young white men came up to my daughter's boyfriend and asked him if he had drugs to sell. And, you know, we kind of just laughed that off. And then the next day, we were up in the Alps, up on this hiking trail that, in spots, parallels like a tram car line. And we were walking in one direction, and the tram car was coming down. And it's just a single car that comes at one time, and the conductor sits right in front. And the conductor was this young white man. And when he saw my daughter's boyfriend, he looked him in the eye and he went like this as he drove by. And my daughter's boyfriend just, like, you know, walked off to the side of the path. And I could just see the hurt on his face. And it was so awful to feel the violence of that gesture and to see the hurt on his face. It obviously has stayed with me. And I realize that I was just witnessing these two isolated events in 2 days of his life. You know, that he is subject to this all the time. Okay, so moving ahead, I was one of the founders of East Bay Meditation Center, and early on we decided that we intentionally wanted to set about welcoming diversity, creating a diverse place of meditation. And this required really hearing the experiences of the people of color. How they felt unseen and unsafe in most predominantly white convert Buddhist meditation centers. So hearing those words, white privilege and white supremacy, and feeling the discomfort of white guilt, feeling the discomfort of shame and ignorance, And feeling the challenge to my identity as a good person, right? I'm a good person, therefore I'm not racist, therefore if you're bringing up these topics, it's going to make me uncomfortable and question my own goodness and make me more uncomfortable and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that challenge comes up, how can I be good and still be implicit in racism? So I wanted to stay engaged in the process, but I felt like suddenly the ground was shifting and I didn't know the rules anymore. And I was almost certain to make mistakes and you know, do wrong things. So there was lots of uncertainty and anxiety. Fortunately, we had a group of very generous people of color who were willing to do some initial educating of us and then to encourage us to keep going and do our own educating. But we had that blessing of people of color who were willing to share their distress, I'm sure adding even more to their distress in the process, to require that the white members of the board begin to educate ourselves about race and racism and how it really works in our world. Now, Ruth King has written a great book, and I'm going to be reading a little bit from it later on. It's called Mindful of Race, and I recommend it because it puts the issues of race and of waking up to the realities of it in the context of Dharma practice. And that really is a game changer in terms of being able to heal and transform suffering. So Ruth King calls racism a heart disease which affects all of us. For people of color, there is the direct emotional and physical harm caused daily by racism. And for white people, there is the disconnection of having to cut off part of our heart so that we don't see this suffering and we don't acknowledge it and we don't deal with it. We have to wall off part of our hearts to maintain our ignorance of white domination and to not feel the pain of those directly affected by racism. Now, the good news is that Ruth King asserts that this heart disease can be healed, especially using the tools of Dharma. So part of the title of this talk was like fish in water, and I want to take that analogy and work with it a little more. This is a quote from a website called Racial Equity Tools. There's a story told about the wise old fish who was swimming through the water. As he swam along, he encountered two young fish coming by. He turned to them and asked, "How's the water?" And the young fish replied, "What water?" So this is, I'm still continuing to quote this this site here. "Most of us who are white are like the young fish in the ocean. We don't see our whiteness, and we don't see how our white skin color gives us undue privilege." Anti-racism educator Robert Terry writes, quote, "Being white means not having to think about it," end quote. Whiteness is the norm of our society. And so it's hard for us as white people to see how it is operating. People of color see it all the time. And that's the end of this quote from Racial Equity Tools. So to take this analogy of fish in water, as white people were like fish swimming in water, kind of oblivious to our surroundings, there's something in the water that benefits us by taking resources from and disadvantaging the other fish. But we don't have to pay attention to this thing because we're not the ones directly harmed by it. And yet it causes the entire ecosystem to be unhealthy. In the past, fish just like us built this thing. We've been taught not to see it. And although we didn't build it ourselves, and even if we don't actively work to maintain it, our ignorance helps it continue. If we don't work to understand it and take it apart, that will never happen. So I don't consider myself really to be a social activist. And yet I do consider myself to have direct responsibility for becoming aware of the issues around being white in a racist society and what my possible role might be in helping to unravel that. As a Buddhist, I aspire to be compassionate to all suffering beings. I aspire to see with wisdom the suffering that's caused by all the othering that we do all the time, whether it's anti-Semitism or racism or sexism or ableism or heterosexism or anti-Muslim views and so on and so on, all the ways that we divide ourselves off from each other. I aspire to what Martin Luther King Jr. called the beloved community, an inclusive society in which everyone is loved and valued and nurtured. And in doing this work, it's necessary for us to nurture our own hearts, to keep our own goodness in sight, and to honor it, to have faith in it, while we are still directly looking at the ways that we're still asleep, that we're still not seeing the truth. So I want to say just a little bit about white privilege. It goes back to that thing about flesh color, which I talked about in the beginning. Tara Brach has recently talked about the fact that she realized that when describing people, she only refers to someone's race when the person is not white. So my brother-in-law, who is African-American, or my Chinese doctor, or my Hispanic friend, these habits of speech also reflect the fact that in our culture, white is not considered a race, it's just considered normal. Other people have race, I'm just normal. Whatever normal might be. And this is an unconscious foundation of white dominance. White is normal, everyone else is different than normal. And therefore, a little bit less than. There's a woman who's done a lot of work around the issue of white privilege. Her name is Peggy McIntosh. And here are some quotes from her. "I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems conferring dominance on my group. As a white person, I realized I had been taught about racism as something that puts others at a disadvantage, but had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage." "I think whites are carefully taught not to recognize white privilege, so I have begun in an untutored way to ask what it is like to have white privilege. I have come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. So this is a really great article called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, or the Invisible Backpack. Sorry, I think I'm not saying that quite right. And she gives this whole list, and I'm going to just read a few of the ways that she recognizes white privilege. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. If a traffic cop pulls me over or if the IRS audits my tax return, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. There's another book which I have found really helpful. It's called Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race, and it's by Debbie Irving. And she has a chapter in that book which made a big impression on me called Headwinds and Tailwinds, where she talks about the ways in which white people are given tailwinds in life and people of color consistently face headwinds. So it may only be a little bit in the educational system that pushes me as a white person a little bit forward that is resisting to people of color. It may only be a little bit in a financial exchange that pushes me a little bit ahead and provides a little more resistance to people of color. It may only be a little bit in the racial, in the criminal justice system that does the same thing, or in employment, or in the medical system, so on and so on. But these cumulative little headwinds and tailwinds really add up, and sometimes they're really big ones, like what happened after World War II with redlining, which has played out to this day in the accumulation of wealth and the difference in the accumulation of wealth between white communities and communities of color, especially African American communities. So this idea of headwinds and tailwinds, you know, we don't necessarily see them all the time, especially white people don't. And so we assume that we've gotten where we've gotten simply on the merits and on our hard work. And we may have plenty of merits, and we may work really hard, but we're still being pushed a little bit further ahead by these things that are endemic in our society. And then there's this thing called white white fragility. And the person who's done a lot of work on this is named Robin DiAngelo. White people in North America live in a social environment that protects and insulates them from race-based stress. This insulated environment of racial protection builds white expectations for racial comfort while at the same time lowering the ability to tolerate racial stress, leading to what I refer to as white fragility. White fragility is a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of emotions, such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-induced situation. These behaviors, in turn, function to reinstate white racial equilibrium. So this white fragility points to the guilt and shame and discomfort that white people feel when dealing with race and the limited ability that many white people have to tolerate that discomfort. For me, I see this in the difficulty remembering what I've learned in my work with white privilege and racism, in doubting that I have anything to offer in doing a talk like this, in the fear of failure, in the fear of being disliked, or the fear of making others uncomfortable. This is the conditioning of whiteness. Robin says, whites have not had to build the cognitive or affective skills or develop the stamina that would allow for constructive engagement across racial divides. So this is the conditioning. This is a very important thing to understand, that it's conditioning, because that means that it can be undone. It can be unlearned. Other skills can be developed. And the Dharma offers us strong tools to help us do that. So I got up here tonight, and I took off my shoes, and I noticed that I have socks that say stamina on them. And I thought that was actually quite funny. Because I didn't pick it that way, but there they are. I'm wearing my stamina socks. And I'm going to talk about these three aspects of developing cognitive tools, affective tools, and stamina, just a little bit from a Dharma lens. So one thing that we've done at East Bay Meditation Center in offering classes on to help white people wake up to racism is we've framed it in a dharmic lens, which is super helpful, because we're going in not with the idea of blame, but the idea of waking up, right? Really looking through these lenses of wisdom and compassion. And in this case, you know, wisdom has to do with seeing the truth, right? I mean, wisdom always has to do with seeing the truth. So in terms of racism and relative to being white, it's educating ourselves. It's waking up to these realities. It's working with other white people. Because part of what happens is, you know, white people who want to be viewed as good and not racist, when the topic comes up, they will turn to people of color and say, "Won't you educate me?" And that becomes a huge burden on people of color to have to do that all the time, again and again. Do I really have to point out to you again, you know, this aspect of what you're not seeing? And so it's really up to us to educate ourselves and to do that work amongst ourselves as white people, to recover what it is to be white, and to really embrace that, not just the negative, but the positive as well, to embrace our individual ethnic identities, right? I'm Scandinavian and German. You know, I have a very small association with that ethnic heritage, and an even smaller one with the idea of being white, and yet here I am, steeped in it, right? So, wisdom, seeing the truth, educating ourselves, and working with other white people, and holding that in the truth of the wisdom of the Dharma. You know, that we're all precious human beings, that we are subject to impermanence and suffering, and that ultimately it's not personal. I still have responsibility, but to the extent that I can not take this discomfort around racism quite so personally, I can probably open up to it more easily. So this wisdom aspect includes learning how racism has functioned historically in all aspects of our society, and then learning about white culture, reclaiming what it is to be white. So these are some of the cognitive underpinnings of waking up. Then there's the compassion side of things, which is holding the suffering with care, holding all of the suffering with care, the suffering of people of color, of course, the suffering of white people too, in our disconnection with parts of ourselves and in our unawareness of what's going on. So we need to be tender with ourselves as we do this work. We need to nurture the capacity of our own hearts to open. That's hugely important. So these are some of the affective skills needed to wake up. And of course, loving kindness practice, compassion practice. These are huge tools. Also sympathetic joy and equanimity. I shouldn't leave those out. So. And then continuing the work. This is not a one-shot deal. It's not like I go to a racial awareness seminar this weekend and then I'm done. Got the t-shirt, checked that box, good to go, right? This is work that's ongoing. It's why we need our stamina socks. It's why we need to come back again and again. We go to a we as white people tend to go to these courses and it slides right off. We remember, we're dedicated, and then whoosh, we forget again. So we need to do it over and over again. And that's what develops stamina. When I was in the community Dharma Leader training program, I was in cohort number 3. And our cohort was the first one that had really started to be diverse. And so we had out of about 100 participants, I think we had about 20 people of color. So it was starting to be a little bit diverse. And there was huge difficulty in the group as we formed and started to do the training. The people of color were feeling very unsafe. The white people were feeling very challenged. There was a lot of white fragility manifesting. Some white people left the program because it was too much for them. I remember feeling really dedicated to wanting to stay there in the room and having not a clue about what I was doing. And so I just stayed. And later on, one of the people of color, in I think our fourth, we had 5 retreats together, I think it was the 4th retreat, the people of color had decided to do a fishbowl exercise where they got in the center of this whole group of otherwise white people and shared what it was like to experience racism. And one of the people of color who was my friend also said, "We're going to do this thing, and I want you sitting where I can see you because I need to know that there's a friendly face." And I was so touched because all I had done, I hadn't done anything skillful that I could see yet in terms of dealing with white privilege. The only thing I had done was not leave. And so that gave me a little faith that at least by staying in the game, there was something of value to be had for that. And I was completely honored that she asked me to sit in this place where I could be providing some strength for her. Of course, mindfulness, you know, which is present moment awareness of what's true right now without judgment and as much as possible with some attitude of kindness. For me, it's really important to have a reference point for the heart in doing this work. Some experience that you bookmark in your heart that reminds you why this work is so important. Now, I know people of color don't need to have this because it's so much a part of everyday experience. But for me, I'm trying to bookmark the experience and the emotional tone that keeps my motivation strong for doing this work. And today, it's that image of my daughter's boyfriend. And that scene in Switzerland that really brought it home for me. So I'm going to read this quote from Ruth King. Which I find very helpful. Ultimate reality is what we aspire to in spiritual practice, a felt sense of universal belonging, peace, and harmony that is beyond the limits of concepts. Yet at the core of racial suffering is a forgetting that we belong. At the core of racial suffering is a forgetting that we belong. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of this eloquently. All life is interrelated, and we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. And now we're back to Ruth King speaking again. This interrelated structure of reality points us toward the idea of ultimate reality or non-duality, our kinship in each other's lives. Our kinship in each other's lives. And I'm going to close by reading a poem from Robert Hall, which is called The Torrent. If you sit very quietly, you will eventually notice a torrent of life stuff pouring toward you, entering into your heart, breaking through the uppermost gates, filling all your empty reservoirs, carrying on its foaming crest sure wisdom, heart food, and kinship with all the trees. The silent earth will bear testimony. The sitting body will be the portal, offering its head and heart to be in union with the great mind that thinks all things. There is nothing to build. Everything is already in place. So open the sluice gates, release the contracted heart. Listen carefully, like you would listen for your lover. Hear the presence of life itself, filling what you call your own, replacing struggle, substituting happiness for fear. That power, that wild river, will rush into all your hidden corners, transform itself to rapture when you see what has come to visit is simply everything you are, making you divine, another member of the human race, belonging to the species, everything that lives. So thank you for your attention, and we have a little time for questions or comments.
Okay, is this okay? All right. I wanted to say thank you so much for your talk. I felt like you covered a lot of ground that needs to be covered again and again. And I'm also, I just wanted to say I also live in Oakland, and I love Oakland, and I love the diversity of Oakland. And I've also been, I think, kind of going through a process of educating myself about white privilege in a variety of ways. And one of the I just thought I'd share this. One of the things that has been helpful for me in this sort of self-education process is film. There are just some amazing movies out there that I think really can help people experience the depths of the experience of particularly African Americans in this country, and really understand the history. And that's like, for me, that was a really, that sort of form, the form of a film, was a way to learn and deepen my own knowledge. And I mean, I'll just share a few of them that I really thought were profound, incredibly profound. One of them is I Am Not Your Negro, about the life of James Baldwin, which is an incredibly powerful film, really helped me understand a lot more. And Ava DuVernay's film 13, which is available on Netflix, and it's about the 13th Amendment, which supposedly ended slavery. And just there's a host more. If anyone is interested, I'd be happy to. I've been making a list. I'm going to do something with. But again, I just really wanted to thank you. I think this is just so incredibly important. And Wilfree, I can't say. I can go on and on, so I'll just leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Film, books, music, seeking out the works of people of color, the artworks of people of color in all venues, really helpful. And then talking to other white people about our experience, about race. Yeah. Don't y'all clam up now.
I guess I'll share.
Please.
Recently I was... Two things. I don't know what the value of this is, but I got interested in World War I. And I mean the black soldiers in World War I. I mean, it's, everybody, they kill hundreds of thousands of people, And these guys would go into impossible situations and survive and, be commended. And then they would come back here. Just, it's pretty hard to take how they were treated. Yeah. But also, I went to Sequoia this summer, and they had like a Buffalo Soldier thing. And it was very educational, the role that these soldiers played in the late 1800s. And they're brilliant. Men acting out like I'm Booker T. Washington, and the guy would be dressed like a Buffalo Soldier. It just increases the respect I have for black people in this case, and how little we know about them as just a white guy. So. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out a couple of things. Two or three Sundays ago, the New York Times Sunday magazine was entitled 1619. This is the 400th anniversary of slavery in this country. And there's a website put together by Pulitzer if people want to get really into it. Into the history of it. And two other things I'd like to mention. It's not just African Americans. At times it's been, in World War II, the Japanese internments, the Native Americans. In my own tradition of coming out of a Jewish family, the Holocaust, and there were echoes of that in my own family in this country. And so it's not a particular racial group or even a particular ethnic group that this kind of thing is happening. In India now, the Islamic people are being created as a racist thing by the Hindus. Mm-hmm. In Western China, the Islamic folks are persona non grata for the Han Chinese. So it's not just racism, it's a history of one group of people in one culture exploiting and naming another group as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And there's some wonderful books. Umberto Eco, his last book of essays, the title essay is called Inventing the Enemy. And he traces that back in written history to the Greek and Roman times. And there's a book by Sam Keen called Faces of the Enemy, in which he looks at all kinds of political posters that have been existing in one country where they make an enemy of another country. And he has posters going back to the French Revolution, you know, up through World War II. So it's more than just racism. It's when one group of people in a dominant group in a society picks another group for the enemy. Mm-hmm. And even now in this country, it's not just the African Americans. It's the Hispanic Americans, you know, that are the main focus of our undemocratically elected president. So I'm just trying to say it's a much broader phenomenon than just racism in this country. And Jung talks a lot about how one group creates a psychology of the shadow, mm-hmm. to use as a projection against another group.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful book by Robert Bly called A Little Book on the Human Shadow, where he talks about that in his own history. So, anyhow, thank you for bringing it up. And I just wanted to create some additional perspectives and resources if people want to follow up on any of that.
I think this person here.
Well, really close to home, we had a really sad thing in my family. My cousins, who are just lovely people, he's a meditator. She's in restorative justice. I've never talked to them about that, but I bet they were involved with civil rights stuff. And then their daughter, really, really good parents. Their daughter got involved with a man from Jamaica. And they were completely, completely unaccepting. It was like they just put up a wall and he was not going to cross it. And it really kind of shocked the other members of the family who I'm close to, who I can talk to about it. We just did not expect that kind of reaction from them. And we don't know if there was some reason other than race, but it looked like it was racism, mm-hmm. and made me very sad. Eventually, they did come around. They saw that they were going to lose their daughter if they didn't, and that was the motivation to do the work on themselves that they needed to do. And so now I think everything is fine now. But and the fact that he would put up with that, you know, that speaks really well for him, that he would keep his heart open to them while they were doing that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see that and to, you know, there's so much suffering, I mean, that we've all been talking about. And there's an example where it looks like they were able to overcome their conditioning to some degree anyway, enough to, you know, bridge some of that suffering and allow them to still have their relationship with their daughter and with her partner. So, yeah, I know, it's like, It's so amazing how we other, so, you know, over all these different, I mean, it's, sometimes it's just like Hatfield and McCoy stuff, right? It's like family feuds between two families. And then there are these hugely overriding structures of racism that also function. So thank you for bringing that up. And we have just time for one more in the back there, and then we'll need to wrap up the evening.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the challenge and the courage to talk about this. I really related to the in myself the projection. That's one thing I have seen and I see continuing to need to work on. And then the other thing I've been wrestling with that you've brought to the fore tonight is in my own experience. When I come at relationships with the people in my life of color through the filter of thinking of them as people of color that I want to reach out to because of racial suffering, I feel a wall come up and a formality to the interaction. And so I have made a commitment or attempted to be available and listen to how each relationship wants to unfold. But now I'm teaching in a program where they're making a special priority of inclusion, and people are challenging me to realize that in a formal setting, I need to make a concerted formal effort. So I'm finding that very interesting to try and reconcile those two, which is letting something unfold in the relationship as human beings versus creating a formal space for a topic that needs to be discussed. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't expect any answers on it, but it's very relevant as you're bringing this up.
Yeah, we have to negotiate those things, you know, differently. Like our personal relationships are one thing, and you know, we need to look at our own motivation. It's like, am I reaching out to this person of color because it's somehow making me a better person if I have them as a friend, or because I really want to be their friend, right? And so we need to look at those motivations. And and then also, there may be other settings where we want to specifically build in to the structure of the organization things that will allow for inclusivity and safety and really space, you know, making space for groups other than the white dominant groups. So, yeah, thank you. Okay. Well, once again, I appreciate your kind attention, and let's practice together a little bit and finish up the evening. So let's begin by returning to a sense of the body, this physical vessel that's doing such a good job of supporting us in this life, this precious human form. And remembering our intentions for being here tonight, for being on this path, honoring those as well, and holding ourselves tenderly with great care, with exquisite care, wishing may we be safe, may we be peaceful, may we be happy, may we be free. And then understanding that we share goodness and similar intentions for being on this path. We share that with each other, including each other in this room, in this field of loving kindness, wishing may we be safe and protected. May we be peaceful and happy. May we be strong and healthy. May we take care of ourselves joyfully. May we love ourselves completely, just as we are. And extending this field of care and compassion wider to include all those we love. And especially tonight, to include Jackie and Loretta, who are dealing with divorce. To include Thomas, who's struggling with addiction. To include Scott Chan and his daughter Kendra and their family grieving their loss in a diving boat that sank this past weekend. To include all those suffering with loss. And then letting that well-wishing spread even wider. Now to include all those we know. Whether they're experiencing joy or sorrow. And finally, extending outward into the world in all directions to include all those we don't know. Wishing each one without exception. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful and happy. May you take care of yourself joyfully. May you live with deep ease and well-being. We dedicate our work here tonight to the awakening of each other and all beings. May all beings come to the end of suffering. May all beings realize their true nature. May all beings be peaceful and happy and free. Once again, thank you all for being here, and I wish you a peaceful week.